I'm responsible for your silliness because I did the same thing that you're doing now for 10 years. I protected Mr. Trump for 10 years.
Michael Cohen, President Donald Trump's former personal attorney, testified for nearly 8 hours before the House Oversight Committee on Wednesday. The explosive hearing covered a lot of ground, including how President Trump conducted private business operations while in office, the details of hush money payments he made to adult film star Stormy Daniels, and what he knew about the WikiLeaks email dump. President Trump's personal finances were also a point of contention.
It was my experience that Mr. Trump inflated his total assets when it served his purposes, such as trying to be listed amongst the wealthiest people in Forbes, and deflated his assets to reduce his real estate taxes.
And in his opening remarks, Michael Cohen literally brought the receipts.
Copies of financial statements from 2011, 2012, and 2013 that he gave to such institutions such as Deutsche Bank.
The documents are a summary of Trump's net worth, categorizing assets, including cash and properties, and liabilities. In 2013, those documents show Trump's net worth nearly doubling thanks to a new $4 billion line item attributed to something known as brand value.
Did this information provided to us inflate the president's assets?
I believe these numbers are inflated.
Under questioning you just heard from Representative Lacey Clay of Missouri, Michael Cohen said Donald Trump lied about how much money he had when it suited his interests.
Did the president ever provide inflated assets to a bank in order to help him obtain a loan?
These documents and others were provided to Deutsche Bank on one occasion where I was with them in our attempt to obtain money so that we can put a bid on the Buffalo Bills.
But this is not the first time Deutsche Bank's involvement in lending to Donald Trump has come to the attention of Congress. In fact, last month, the House Intelligence and Financial Services Committees launched an investigation into the president's dealings with the German financial giant. So what is the House looking for, and what does Michael Cohen's testimony reveal about Deutsche Bank's relationship with President Trump? That's where we begin today. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and I'm joined now by two journalists who've been covering Deutsche Bank and its relationship with President Trump closely. Jenny Strasberg is a senior correspondent for European finance at The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to The Takeaway, Jenny.
Thank you very much.
And David Enrich is finance editor at The New York Times, and he's writing a book on Deutsche Bank and Trump. Perfect timing, David. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Jenny, let's start with you. For those of us here who are less familiar with Deutsche Bank, can you give us who are they and what is their presence in the United States?
Sure. So they've been around since the late 1800s, started as a German bank to serve German corporates. And really, they came onto the scene in the United States with their deal in 1998 to buy Bankers Trust, which put them on the Wall Street radar. And with that grew their aspirations to take on the likes of Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and the big investment banks. And then that became the source of many a regulatory issue for the bank, particularly during and since the financial crisis. And it's no exaggeration to say that their future has become a huge question mark, but the Trump topic is front and center there, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, David, let's talk a little bit about that. You're literally writing the book on this. How far back does President Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank go?
It goes back, it really starts in earnest in the late 90s, around the time, as Jenny said, that Deutsche Bank developed these really strong aspirations to be a proper U.S. investment bank, to compete with Wall Street. And Deutsche Bank viewed Donald Trump as the perfect type of person to do business with because he was a guy who had defaulted on his debts to other banks, and therefore other banks weren't willing to take the risk of doing business with him. Deutsche Bank needed a foothold in the United States, and so it needed to do business with people and with institutions that other banks were not willing to touch with a 10-foot pole. Donald Trump fit that perfectly, and off to the races they went.
David, do we have any sense of how much money Trump has borrowed so far from Deutsche Bank and whether any of that is still outstanding?
Yeah, and Trump over the years, over the 20 years between 1998 and now, borrowed well over $2 billion.
And that's billion with a B.
Billion with a B. It's a huge number, especially given what we know about the limited amount we know about Trump's net worth, which is, you know, he says he's a billionaire. That's far from clear that it's actually true. So the fact that he's borrowed over 15 or 20 years billions of dollars from Deutsche Bank is extraordinary. Currently, a lot of that's been repaid or in some cases defaulted on by Trump, so it's not still outstanding. As of the time he entered the White House, though, he still owed more than $300 million to Deutsche Bank. It was his biggest creditor. And that's really, it's a really extraordinary thing to think about, that the president of the United States is deeply, deeply in debt to a foreign institution.
Jenny, I want to bring you back in here because we're talking about Deutsche Bank today mostly because of Michael Cohen's testimony yesterday. And yesterday, he supplied records outlining President Trump's efforts to secure a loan from Deutsche Bank from 2011 to 2013. Michael Cohen said that this loan was part of a failed effort to buy the Buffalo Bills or to buy a share in the Bills. Jenny, would Deutsche Bank have known that President Trump's statements had been inflated, as Michael Cohen suggested in his testimony yesterday?
Well, I mean, it was certainly dramatic and exciting to hear from a longtime insider. We covered a secret deposition in the lawsuit in 2007 where Trump acknowledged that he was no stranger to inflating his property values. He said, and I'll quote from our article, "I think everybody does. Who wouldn't?" Now, this is a private deposition. And he said, even verbally, he inflates the value of properties in general, not beyond reason. So this is not the first time this topic has come up.
And this also came up quite a bit in the testimony with Cohen yesterday. And David, I'm curious to know, Deutsche Bank did cut Trump off at some point.
Yeah, I mean, very relatively recently. It wasn't until the early days of the presidential primaries in 2016.
What was the impetus for that?
The impetus was that Trump went back to them one more time for another loan for quite a bit of money that seemed to ostensibly be headed toward a golf resort he owns in Scotland. And at this point, this request went up the chain of command at Deutsche Bank. And for the first time, senior executives said, no, this is crazy. The guy is, first of all, he's very controversial. Second of all, he's running for president. It's crazy to throw more money at him. And going back to the Bills loan, which I think is really interesting, and I talked yesterday to people. I'd never heard about this Bills loan until yesterday, which is weird because I've been reporting on this for well over a year. And talking to people yesterday who were involved in this process and knew about this loan request and had seen those documents, and they had looked at those assets. It wasn't just the $4 billion figure. It was just individual pieces of real estate that he was clearly overvaluing. And Deutsche Bank had a practice when they would look at financial statements from Trump, and they would just mark down the assets by 60 or 70%, so they knew this guy was a fabulist and an exaggerator and a defaulter, and yet they still had the stomach to do business with him.
The House Financial Services Committee is potentially going to investigate this now that there's a Democratic majority. Your thoughts, David?
Well, I think the holy grail here for investigators in Congress and for many of us in the media is the Russia connection. And as Jenny just said, Deutsche Bank has gotten in a lot of trouble for money laundering for Russians. What investigators and journalists like me and Jenny want to know is Deutsche Bank the nexus between Donald Trump and Russia? Did money from Russia go to Donald Trump by way of Deutsche Bank? We don't know the answer to that yet. Journalists have been trying for years to figure that out, but we do not have subpoena power. House Democrats now do. And so I think we're going to get some answers.
So, David, we just mentioned the potential for a House investigation. I'm wondering if you can tell us what threads you think they will follow.
I think the big thread is whether Deutsche Bank has been a channel for money to illicitly come to Donald Trump over the years from Russia. And the reason this is interesting is that Deutsche Bank for many years was a pioneer of lending in Russia and of building relationships with large Putin-connected, Kremlin-connected banks. And so the rumor that has circulated for a couple of years now is that part of the reason Deutsche Bank was willing to take such risks and lend to Donald Trump when no one else would is that someone in Russia or something in Russia was providing them some sort of protection against the risk of Trump defaulting. And that's unproven. It's unconfirmed. God knows I've been trying, and I know Jenny has been too. And we just don't know if it's true, but there's a lot of the questions that people like Maxine Waters, who's the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, and Adam Schiff, who's the chairman of House Intelligence, have been asking, make it quite clear that this is exactly what they're gunning for. And, or at least it's one of the things that they're gunning for. And I don't know what they're going to find, but they have a much better chance of finding that out with subpoena power and with some of the really serious investigators that they've brought on recently than mere mortals like me.
Or like, should we say, like the rest of us journalists here trying to make sense. David, if Trump were to default on these loans, what could that mean for Deutsche Bank? I mean, would it matter to a bank that large, or would it be a pretty intense hit?
Financially, it doesn't matter all that much. I mean, this is a bank with hundreds of billions of dollars in assets, and Trump's outstanding loans are, you know, around $300 million right now. Reputationally, politically, is hard to overstate how much it would matter. This is one of the reasons Trump has been able to receive so many loans from Deutsche Bank is that they have extracted from him what's called a personal guarantee. So each time Deutsche Bank makes a loan, Trump, these aren't going to Trump directly. They go to these LLCs that Trump controls, which are supposed to shield his personal money from being seized if he defaults. Well, in some of these cases, including the most recent loan Deutsche Bank did to Trump, which is for the old post office building in Washington, D.C., Trump's personal guarantee is attached, which means if he defaults, Deutsche can seize his money, his cash at the bank, his personal assets, whether it's an airplane or something like Mar-a-Lago. So they have extraordinary power over him if he defaults. And again, that seems like a weird theoretical, but keep in mind that Trump defaults over and over and over again. This is one of his defining traits as a businessman. And so it's not really that theoretical question. It's a very real question. And I can tell you, Deutsche Bank executives are terrified about this. They're terrified about being in the situation of if Trump defaults or falls behind on his loan payments, what do they do? Do they seize the president's assets? That's crazy. On the other hand,
is it? I mean, we're in a moment that just feels crazy.
Everything is crazy now, so that's a given. But that would be an extraordinary step for them, for the bank to take, especially since the bank is regulated and subject to prosecution by the federal government, which Donald Trump controls. On the other hand, if Trump were to default and Deutsche Bank were not to seize his assets, that's essentially an enormous in-kind gift, a huge financial gift to the president of the United States, which at best looks awful. At worst, it violates campaign finance rules. It violates, I don't even know what, but it's at best very unseemly. And so Deutsche Bank is stuck in this situation of its own making where in the possible event that Donald Trump doesn't pay back his money, they have a menu of awful options to choose from.
David Enrich is finance editor at The New York Times, working on a book about Deutsche Bank and Trump. And Jenny Strasberg is senior correspondent for European finance for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
And we should add, we reached out to Deutsche Bank for comment on its lending to the Trump Organization, and the bank declined to comment.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
So we continue to work, and we'll see, but we had to walk away from that particular suggestion. We had to walk away from that. Basically, they wanted the sanctions lifted in their entirety, and we couldn't do that. They were willing to denuke a large portion of the areas that we wanted, but we couldn't give up all of the sanctions for that.
Seems to me you don't want to talk about it. Seems to me you just turn your pretty head and walk away.
Walk away from that, and we couldn't do that. But we're going to see. Frankly, I think we'll end up being very good friends with Chairman Kim and with North Korea, and I think they have tremendous potential.
President Donald Trump there at a news conference in Hanoi, Vietnam, early this morning after talks collapsed at the summit between the United States and North Korea. So to make sense of things, we turn to David Scheer, former U.S. ambassador to Vietnam and assistant secretary of defense. He was also the deputy director of the Korea desk during Madeleine Albright's 2000 visit to Pyongyang. And he's currently senior advisor to McLarty Associates. David, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tanzina. It's great to be with you today.
So there hasn't been a lot of movement between North Korea and the United States since the last summit, if you will. What's the significance of the talks sort of breaking down as they did?
Well, I wasn't surprised by the breakdown of the talks. The sequencing of North Korean denuclearization, as well as the sequencing of our lifting of the sanctions, is an extremely difficult issue. And it was clear that neither side had an agreement on how to do either of these sequences going into the president's meeting with President Kim. So this is a very difficult issue. And as the president signaled last week in a tweet, I think it could be a lengthy process.
So, David, in a press conference after the talks fell apart, President Trump said that he and Kim Jong-un had talked about Otto Warmbier, the American student who died from brain damage in the United States after he had been imprisoned in North Korea.
I don't believe he knew about it.
Did Kim Jong-un tell you?
He felt badly about it. I did speak to him. He felt very badly. But he knew the case very well, but he knew it later. And, you know, you got a lot of people, a big country, a lot of people. And in those prisons and those camps, you have a lot of people. And some really bad things happened to Otto. Some really, really bad things.
Why are you?
But he tells me, that he didn't know about it. And I will take him at his word.
Is it possible that Kim Jong-un did not know? And what does it tell us that the president of the United States is taking him at his word, as he says?
Well, I think it's astonishing that Kim Jong-un would not know how a high-profile American prisoner was being treated in his own detention facility. I also find it astonishing that the president would give President Kim a pass on this. North Korea is a very severe authoritarian state. President Kim would certainly want to know all of what's going on this. And I'm surprised that the president took President Kim's word on this.
Now, remind us the last summit or the last year's summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un was quite a spectacle. There were agreements made, but those agreements were quite vague. Could you remind us what those agreements were and how they may have been either impacted or completely forgotten this time around?
Well, at Singapore, both sides produced a joint declaration that focused on 4 points. The first point related to the improvement in U.S.-North Korea relations. The second point was on our desire to arrive at a peace agreement. The third point conveyed North Korea's interest in denuclearization. And the fourth point laid out North Korea's promise to work with us on POW-MIAs left over from the Korean War. There has been some progress on POW-MIAs. It's clear that there has not been progress on the other issues, particularly with regard to denuclearization. A big difference between the Singapore summit and this summit was there appeared to have been little preparation going into the Singapore summit, and the result of that was a very vague joint statement. There's been a lot of preparation and a lot of negotiations between the two sides in preparation for this summit. One would have expected more progress as a result of that, particularly since the president's prestige was involved, but that appeared not to have been the case.
Now, obviously, we cannot talk about what happened yesterday without talking about, quite frankly, what the rest of the world was paying attention to, which was the Michael Cohen testimony before Congress. Michael Cohen, obviously, is President Trump's former personal attorney. That testimony was quite explosive. It was damning, if you will. There were new allegations that came out that could potentially implicate the president. I'm wondering if that story, is North Korea following that story, and does that ultimately affect whatever leverage we as a country or Donald Trump as a president has with North Korea?
I have no doubt that President Kim pays very close attention to the news coming out of Washington, particularly with regard to the president and the Cohen case. I suspect that the uncertainty and the chaos in Washington produces in our foreign observers, particularly the North Koreans, the sense that President Trump may be weak domestically, and therefore they can stonewall him at the negotiating table.
Where do negotiations go from here, David? I mean, do they continue? It doesn't feel like we outlined the 4 points that came out of Singapore. I'm wondering, you know, this last negotiation obviously didn't go as well as I'm assuming the president had hoped it would. Is this becoming a show of optics, or is there real potential here for change going forward?
Well, I hope there continues to be potential for change. That was certainly the message the president and Secretary Pompeo tried to convey at their Hanoi press conference overnight. They suggested that their relationship with President Kim remains friendly. They suggested that while we disagreed in the end, we are relatively close. And they said talks will continue and that President Kim pledged not to conduct any nuclear or missile tests in the wake of the failed talks. So there appears to be a basis for continuing those talks. The South Koreans, the Chinese, and the Japanese have certainly made it clear that they hope the talks continue. And while the president wasn't clear when the talks may resume, I'd expect to look for continued negotiation between the two sides.
David Scheer is a former U.S. ambassador to Vietnam and assistant secretary of defense. He's currently a senior advisor to McLarty Associates. David, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Seems to me you don't want to talk about it. Seems to me you just turn your pretty head and
walk. In Southeast Asia, two nuclear powers with a long history of conflict are heading down a dangerous path. This week, the militaries of both India and Pakistan clashed in the contested region of Kashmir. The escalation is sparking worries around violence between the two powers that we haven't seen in decades. Joining us now with more on this evolving situation is Joanna Slater, India Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Joanna, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, happy to be here.
So take us back to what prompted this latest round of tensions.
To go back to what started this is not so long ago. It's February 14th, which is when a massive suicide bombing took place in Indian-controlled Kashmir. It killed 40 Indian paramilitary officers, and it was claimed by a militant group called Jaish-e-Mohammed, which is based in Pakistan. And India has long accused Pakistan of sheltering and supporting this kind of militant group and really not doing anything about it. And so this time it decided to do something about it. It did something it had never done before. And that happened on Tuesday, which was to launch an actual airstrike inside Pakistan on what it said was a Jaish-e-Mohammed training camp.
And I know there's lots of history there. You mentioned some of the tension between India and Pakistan. Could you give us a sense of what the core issue is here between these two parties? And also, what is it about this region, the Kashmir region, that serves as such a sticking point for these two countries?
The Kashmir dispute is as old as India and Pakistan, independent India and Pakistan, that is. So almost 70 years old. Its status has been contested ever since these two countries, India became independent and Pakistan was created in 1947. So there's a long-running source of conflict over Kashmir and who should run Kashmir and whether Kashmiris have the right to independence. And since 1989, there has been an insurgency in the Indian part of Kashmir. Now, in Pakistan, that insurgency is viewed as a kind of fight for independence, freedom fighters, and so on. India views these fighters as militants and terrorists and has accused Pakistan basically of stoking violence in the region. And that's something Pakistan denies, but in reality, Pakistan's intelligence services do have long links to these groups. So you have a tussle over Kashmir, but more precisely, a tussle over militancy in Kashmir and violence in Kashmir and who is responsible for it.
Joanna, these are two nuclear powers. I mean, obviously, there is a concern of what could happen. Do we have a sense of what the tipping point would be in terms of how India or Pakistan could use those weapons?
We don't. I think that's part of the problem, is that this has never happened before. You've never actually had two nuclear-armed powers launch airstrikes on each other or engage in this kind of aerial combat that we saw on Wednesday. So we don't know exactly how far you would have to go. You would have to go pretty far, I think. Neither of these countries obviously is eager for any kind of nuclear conflict. But the ambiguity is always there, unfortunately.
What about the role the United States has played in this conflict historically, and how do you see us being involved or not being involved under this current administration?
The United States traditionally, at least in the last couple of decades, has played a key role in diffusing tensions between India and Pakistan. I'm thinking of, in particular, in 1999, which is the last time they really clashed militarily. It was in a short but intense conflict in Kargil, high in the Himalayan mountains in Kashmir, and Bill Clinton helped resolve that conflict. The U.S. appears to have been engaged currently, both with Secretary Pompeo, Secretary of State Pompeo, and also through the Pentagon. Just this morning, President Trump, when he was in Hanoi, said that he expected some reasonably decent news to de-escalate the situation, and that turned out to be true. We've just had the news recently that that Pakistan has said it will release the pilot, the Indian pilot that it captured yesterday. So that is definitely a step in the right direction in terms of diffusing things.
What about life on the ground for those people who are living in the Kashmir region?
I think they will be very relieved to hear that Pakistan is releasing this pilot and that tensions are likely to ease. It has been a very frightening time for people in Kashmir, especially for people who live near the line of control, which is the unofficial border that divides Kashmir into its Indian and Pakistani parts. There's been heavy shelling. It's not unusual for the two countries to actually shell each other across that border, but it's been very heavy. And yesterday, of course, with this aerial encounter, airports were closed across the region, and there was a real sense of that anything could happen yesterday.
Joanna Slater is the India Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Joanna, thank you.
Thank you.
Pop superstar Michael Jackson died in June 2009, but his music has remained incredibly successful. In 2018, the Jackson estate reportedly earned $400 million. Before Jackson's death, he was trailed by accusations of child abuse and molestation. In 1994, Jackson settled a lawsuit with a 14-year-old who had accused Jackson of molesting him. Here's Jackson speaking with ABC's Diane Sawyer in 1995.
Did you ever, as this young boy said you did you ever sexually engage, fondle, have sexual contact with this child or any other child?
Never, ever. I could never harm a child or anyone. It's not in my heart. It's not who I am. And it's not what I'm not even interested in that.
In 2005, Jackson was acquitted of 7 counts of child abuse. But this weekend, a new documentary called Leaving Neverland is premiering on HBO, and it tells the stories of James Safechuck and Wade Robson, who both say that they were abused by Jackson as children. Robson spoke with Inside Edition about the abuse last year.
Every time we were together, it happened. There was no night that went by that I was with him that he didn't sexually abuse me.
Members of Michael Jackson's family have responded by calling the film a, quote, public lynching and saying, quote, the facts don't lie, people do. Michael Jackson was and always will be 100% innocent of these false allegations. But for more on what the film reveals about Michael Jackson and his legacy, I'm joined by Hannah Georges, culture writer for The Atlantic. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Your piece was fantastic.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about what you saw. You were at the screening at Sundance. What was the screening like?
I went to the second screening, which was in Salt Lake City. The one beforehand had been in Park City, so the sort of other part of Sundance. Because it was a second screening, people were aware that there had been threats and that there was, you know, a fear around safety for the second screening. There were protesters outside. There was very sort of enhanced security as we came into the screening. And it was very clear that something was happening.
So let's talk a little bit briefly about how the film portrays Michael Jackson.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that this is a film, a two-part documentary, that is much more clearly about the two men and about their lives than it is about sort of making a claim or really sort of trying to take Jackson down. But it does give the sense, through the men's testimony, that Jackson is someone who is troubled, you know, who, you know, according to them, sought them out and sort of commingled affection and abuse. In a way that for young boys was particularly damaging or, you know, to them was both a combination mentor figure and abuser, in their words.
One of the things that's come out here is that both of the film's subjects defended Michael Jackson when they were much younger.
Is that something that the film addresses?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the stronger parts of the film is that a sort of significant part of the second section is really devoted to, in particular, Wade Robson, who testified, speaks about what that decision was like, why he made it, and why he feels, excuse me, why he feels that now or the last few years have been the right time to speak up and to sort of counteract some of what he felt he had to say previously.
You, in your piece for The Atlantic, you're taking a look at three documentaries, yes, that have been done in this sort of Me Too era. We, yes, look at one, you compare the Harvey Weinstein documentary, you look at the R. Kelly documentary. We actually interviewed Dream Hampton on this show about, yes, her work there. And then we look at this one. And in you have you mentioned a phrase, emotional excavation. Mm-hmm. on the part of the victims. What does, right, that mean in films like this?
Right. I mean, so I think what we're seeing, in particularly in this film and in Surviving R. Kelly, you see victims sort of sitting in front of a camera and giving lengthy testimony, detailed testimony, speaking sort of directly to the specifics of what the allegations of abuse are. And it feels, for a viewer, I think it's very overwhelming, it's very affecting. And I think if the intent on the part of the filmmakers is to elicit empathy or to elicit compassion through showing that, it comes through very intently.
The subjects in this movie are both men. I wonder if that has changed anything about whether or not this story, because these were two young boys, they're now grown men, stand out in this broader Me Too movement, in this broader Me Too movement, if you will.
Right, right. I think it's, you know, there's all sorts of big dynamics to wrestle with, right? Like, we're talking about somebody who's a massive superstar. And so that's going to color everything. And it's hard to sort of pull apart which individual dynamic might be operating. But I think we've seen some similar things to what happened with Terry Crews when he, accused the WME agent of assault sort of late last year. There's attacks on manhood and on masculinity that are framed differently than what we see when women come forward, absolutely.
Do we take it as seriously? I mean, given the Terry Crews example, I think, right, I'm thinking now about how much he had to really defend,
right,
himself,
right,
to say, no, I too, despite,
right,
the fact that I'm a man,
right,
you know, experience,
right,
this.
Right. Yeah, I think it's oftentimes hard for people who are unfamiliar with dynamics of abuse or unfamiliar with these kinds of stories to think about power broadly, right? And to think about how somebody who might look powerful might not actually be empowered in a specific situation, or might, you know, there might be another person who has power over them. And so when that dynamic feels sort of unteased out, for lack of a clearer framing, that's sort of what happens there, yes.
Of course, a lot of us are grappling with, we Harvey Weinstein is alive, R. Kelly is alive,
right,
Michael Jackson,
right,
obviously,
right,
is not.
Right.
How does that matter in how we as a culture look at their work? You know, we've had the Mute R. Kelly. He's lost a lot of his work so,
right,
far.
Right.
Harvey Weinstein is essentially, you know, he's battling it out in court right now.
Right.
What does that mean for people with Michael Jackson? Is there a reckoning that can happen after an artist's death?
Right. I don't think there's a sort of clear reckoning in the way that you have Harvey Weinstein being disempowered within the industry, or, you know, R. Kelly now facing criminal investigation. We're obviously not going to see those sorts of things. But it does feel clear to me, at least having watched this documentary, that the goal of the filmmakers, of the filmmaker, and the goal of the men who are coming forward is less to take down Jackson and more so to present stories that they feel they weren't able to share. So it feels much more like like alleged victim, like storytelling and like centering them, than it is really about sort of grappling with Jackson's legacy itself.
Of course, we know the Jackson estate is not happy about,
absolutely,
this film.
Right.
Could they have done more, or, you know, to participate in this or to offer more to this, or...
I think we've seen a very defensive posturing from them. I don't know that there would have been a way for them to have been involved, holding the opinions that they hold, or sort of holding and sticking true to that in a way that would have made sense. I do think it's interesting that they're using similar language to what defenders of R. Kelly have used, which is a sort of racialized public lynching language.
And you also mentioned Clarence Thomas's
right,
use of that phrase.
Right,
yeah,
right. And it sort of pulls on, you know, anxieties that a lot of racialized people, a lot of black folks in particular, have about powerful black men being torn down, or any black men being sort of torn down. It feels strategic in that sense.
Who are these films really for? I mean, I think what's fascinating is you're talking about leaving Neverland as a way to center the victims here. And when we see these films being made, I mean, you're a film critic. What do you want to get from these films going forward?
Yeah, I think the best, the sort of highest and best use, in my opinion, from what I've seen, is films that you know, offer a new light on what dynamics might be and what they might look like, or what this looks like to individual people who say they've experienced these sorts of things, as opposed to sort of conversations happening in a vacuum, but putting that sort of human face on it, I think is what both Surviving R. Kelly and Leaving Neverland do that feels really useful and really, I think, helpful for viewers.
And I'm wondering, just in terms of where we are today, I know it's hard to speculate, but if Michael Jackson were alive today, I mean, would we be looking at this very differently, given the tone and the moment that we're in? We've got about 30 seconds left.
Yeah. Oh gosh. It's really hard to say. I think, you know, he has obviously has a massive fan base, and there are going to be people who are ardent fans no matter what.
No matter what, right?
Just as we've seen with R. Kelly, right? What happens with folks who are sort of in the gray area of not understanding but being willing to come to the table and listen? I'm not sure.
Hannah Georges is a culture writer for The Atlantic. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And all right, everyone, that's our show for today. You can tweet us with any thoughts at The Takeaway or tweet me at Tanzina Vega. And if you missed anything or want to listen back, you can check out our podcast. We'd also like to send a special thank you and farewell to our executive producer, Irva Gunja, who leaves the show today after 9 years. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.